WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From time to time on Fresh Air, we're featuring interviews with our regular contributors so we can find out more about the people who each week offer their views on music, film, and popular culture. Today we profile Ed Ward, our commentator on the history of rock and roll. Ed grew up in New York and has lived in San Francisco and Austin, his current home. Ed began writing about rock and roll in 1967 for Crawdaddy magazine and has since written about music for Rolling Stone, Cream, and the Austin American Statesman. He now writes for the Austin Chronicle. He also co-wrote the book Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, contributing the chapters covering the years up to 1960. I wondered how Ed first started listening to rock and roll.
I can blame this on a kid named Jeffrey Schlossberg, who I was going to school with in third grade, or maybe second. He came into school and said, you know, you better watch out, because my brother's turned into a rock. I'd never heard this term before. In fact, it's a fairly localized one, but essentially what had happened was his brother was in high school, and he had decided to become a hood, and he'd gotten himself a Harley Davidson and a leather jacket. And so I figured, well, you know, this was a guy whose right side I wanted to be on. So went over to Jeffrey's house after school, and we went into his sister's room, and he played a bunch of records that he said would help me understand what this whole phenomenon was about.
What did he play for you?
Well, he played a lot of Elvis Presley records, and to me he sounded like some sort of amphibian singing at the bottom of a well or something. I really didn't like him at all. And he played, I think there was some Buddy Holly in there. And the stuff I responded to best, I guess, back in those days was what has come to be known as doo-wop, you know, black harmony singing. I think that was probably because I was in the church choir and I really liked to sing, and you hear one of these records on the radio and you could sing along with it. You could like find a part in there that you could sing and harmonize with it.
How did you find out about black music?
Well, it was on the radio. I mean, in those days, believe it or not, Top 40 radio was integrated, very much unlike what it is these days. If a record isn't made with a specific crossover intent these days, you generally won't hear it on Top 40. But in those days, rock and roll radio consisted of, there was even country music on rock and roll radio in those days, people like Don Gibson, and that stuff was very much what country people were listening to, and the black stuff, you know, like Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, or the Moon Glows, or people like that, were very much what black people were listening to.
Did you go through periods of abandoning rock and roll for other music?
Oh yeah, during the early '60s, I got disgusted with rock and roll radio because there was less black music being played and more stupid music manufactured for teenagers kind of thing, the infamous Philadelphia sound of Fabian, Frankie Avalon, and all that garbage. And I remember one day I just got so mad, I twisted the dial as hard as I could, and the dial spun all the way down to the end, and I hit WQXR, which was the classical station in New York City, and began listening to classical music pretty much from that moment on. At about that same time, I befriended a pair of twins who were in my junior high school, and their parents had been heavy leftists, and the kids were really into folk music, and we used to go into New York City and see Pete Seeger, and I really got into the folk thing at that point. Pretty much stayed that way till I went to college in 1965.
And then what?
Well, then I came home for Christmas vacation, and my best friend's little brother started making fun of me for being a folkie. And he said, well, you know, the Rolling Stones have recorded a protest song. I said, yeah, sure. You know, the Rolling Stones are just a bunch of commercial pop music mongers. But he put on Satisfaction. And I thought, well, gee, that's a pretty catchy record. So I started listening more to rock and roll at that point.
So the Rolling Stones drew you back into rock and roll?
Yeah, the Rolling Stones. And shortly after that, I guess Rubber Soul came out. And I thought, well, this is sort of the Beatles doing folk music. It was a good time to get back into it. I guess by about 1966, I was really heavily back into it. And I still think of that as, along with 1957, one of the true golden years of rock and roll, because it was just before rock and roll lost its innocence, before the calculatedness came back into it and the sort of people all grasping to become huge stars, there was a lot of really great records that came out in 1966 that were real innocent because nobody really knew what was happening, but they were doing it anyway.
How did you start writing about rock music?
I'd been at school for about 3 weeks, and I was already bored. This was college. And I was a subscriber to a folk music magazine in New York. And I started sending them book and record reviews, and they printed them. And I thought, well, gee, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer, which is, you know, still the case. And here I am, being a writer. So at one point, I was living in New York City, and I read a piece in the Village Voice about Crawdaddy magazine, which had just moved to town from Boston. That was January 1967. So what happened was I wound up moving into the Crawdaddy offices and writing for them. And in about late 1969, I got a copy of Rolling Stone magazine, and there was a call for writers there. And so I submitted some stuff and started publishing, and haven't really stopped since.
When you say you moved into the Crawdaddy offices, I have a feeling you mean literally that you
really lived there. Yeah, we had this great loft at on 6th Avenue, great big old floor, and we just scavenged a couple of mattresses, and that was, you know, we all lived and worked there.
On Fresh Air, you do pieces on the history of rock and roll, and you've also written about that for the Rolling Stone, History of Rock and Roll. How did you become interested in the history of the music? How did you first start researching it?
Well, I always, see, the thing is that was part of believing that rock and roll doesn't exist in a vacuum, that there were all of these different streams that eventually fed into what's happening now and that are still feeding in. It's just, you know, it seems to me that looking at the big picture is the only way to really understand the little picture that's in front of us day by day.
Now, in Philadelphia, where I live, there's a new proliferation of oldie stations, of stations that only play music from the 60s, basically,
mm-hmm.
early through late 60s. And I wonder if you think that this is a good trend or a bad trend. I know that it's happening to some degree around the country.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the largest growing radio format that exists at this point. And that I find that to be really chilling because their view of rock and roll history is an ugly one. I mean, you're not going to hear the Moonglows. You're not going to hear the Five Royales. You're not going to hear anything obscure or anything that's like too ethnic. It's a very carefully managed, very carefully selected view of the past on those stations, and I really don't like that.
On Fresh Air, we think of you as a historian of rock and roll, but I bet you listen to a lot of contemporary rock music.
Oh, I listen mostly to contemporary rock music. It's only when I have to do these shows that I pull out
the old records.
No, I mean, one of the great things about right now is that a lot of the great records of the past are being remastered and reissued. And to that extent, I'm not a record collector nerd, you know. If somebody finds one of my favorite records and remasters it and puts it out on a clean pressing, hey, I'd rather have that than the original.
In Austin, you're still writing about rock music. You're writing about books. And you're also writing about food. You also teach cooking courses, and you teach courses in Cajun cooking. Since you're a native New Yorker, I find it almost ironic that you're teaching courses in Cajun cooking.
Well, actually, the key element here is the fact that I lived in San Francisco. During the Second World War, a bunch of people from Louisiana moved to California to get into the shipbuilding industry. And those Louisiana people stayed on. And early in my stay in San Francisco, I began to go to black Catholic churches where Zydeco music was played, and there would be gumbo for sale there. And since I've always liked to cook, I just started making Louisiana food and started researching it. And years before I'd ever been to Louisiana, actually. And the weird thing was I had friends who were from Louisiana, and they used to come over for dinner and say, man, you know how to do this, don't you? And I didn't really back then, but I'm getting closer.
Okay. Ed, it was really nice to talk with you.
Oh, it's great talking with you.
Ed Ward is Fresh Air's regular contributor on the history of rock and roll. He spoke to us from NPR station KUT in Austin. This is Fresh Air.